This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming. Today, we'll not burden you with a very long talk because we have our full moon ceremony after the talk this morning. It'd be great if people can stay for that. Meanwhile, we can talk a little bit about practice. Sometimes I just like to ask if people have any questions. Rather than hold forth on some topic that I may or may not have thought of much before the talk. So if anyone has any question, general or specific, there's one, okay. Please feel free to ask, and if you're a little reluctant in this atmosphere or because there are people you don't know, please set that aside. We're not known for humiliating visitors, so please just ask whatever you'd like to, and I'll throw in some comments and some sort of other. Did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, it's pretty specific. How often should a person go to Dokusan in a private interview?
Well, it depends a lot on the circumstances. If you're living in a practice community or situation, and that's available, then it's kind of good to take advantage of it. Even if you don't necessarily have anything to talk about. When I was living with my teacher at Green Gulch Farm, he at one point asked to see me, which was very unusual. And I thought, what's this about? But he basically wanted to complain that I wasn't seeing him. I told him, I see you every day, wandering around. We exchange greetings and so forth. But he wanted me to come and sit face to face and talk about the teaching. And that was very appropriate for our connection at the time. But right now, I rarely see him for Dokusan. In fact, it's probably been years since I have. So it really depends on where you are in your practice and what are the resources that your practice environment can provide for you. If it's available, as I say, it's kind of good just to go through the motions, so to speak, and just go in and maybe pay respects to the teacher, or if there's some difficulty in practice, talk about that, or if there's just some general question. And it doesn't have to take long, more than just a few minutes. But I found if I made a point of actually taking up that exercise, it was quite helpful. So, as I say, it depends on the particulars, but if you can get it, then do it. Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
I'm afraid I'm still hung up on that black rock from last week with the water dripping on it. You were talking about a black rock, water dripping.
I don't remember saying it was black.
Well, that's my mom.
Okay. I see sort of the granite kind of with little shiny things in it. Yeah. Anyway, well,
but it was, I don't know, there's just something about, I just got kind of lit up about the slowness of it and the, you know, you said you could use dynamite to blow the rock up, but what was the point of the water gripping on the rock and then using something?
Oh, well, it's just a metaphor for practicing as a sentient being who also is Buddha. And I think it's fairly descriptive of our experience of practice as being, you know, somewhat slow and without a lot of signposts that pop up to indicate progress. And in fact, we're often told not to hang around waiting for signs of progress, don't look for signs of progress. Just keep returning to your Dharma study, your Dharma practice, and to develop that patient attitude which accepts that no matter how slowly the water drips, it will eventually wear through the stone. So that's just a story. An image, and if it's not helpful, by all means, get rid of it.
It was helpful. Because then I contrasted it with like practicing, like you have your ears on fire, your head's on fire, and so you got a different element going on there.
Yeah.
But this was so, it seemed so passive. I think that's why it's not passive, but it seemed, and now I see as you're saying it's sort of cultivating patience.
Yeah. This hair on fire thing that you hear periodically. I think that has really one application, and that is to remind people that we don't necessarily have unlimited time. That image of, you know, practicing with, as though your hair were on fire is a little Hollywood-ish. For me, but it's just to remind us that, well, time is passing in the conventional sense, and we don't know when our particular, when this precious human birth will have to be given up. So make sure it's a priority, just as though if your hair were on fire, putting the fire out would be a priority. So but it does sometimes conjure up a kind of frantic feeling, which I don't think is what was meant at all. It's just meant to remind us to think about our priorities.
Well, there were a rock with water dripping on us, and our hair's on fire, balance out.
So wait, say again?
If we're
sitting on a rock with our hair on fire?
And there's water dripping.
Water dripping, yes?
I think it's
balanced out, okay. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, practice does help us in our lives, often in ways that we don't expect. Most of us, myself certainly included, turned to practice in order to address something that was not. It didn't feel quite right. I was very struck by Shakyamuni Buddha's emphasis on the question of human suffering. And there was plenty of that around once he got out of the palace environment. He began to notice that it was everywhere. that old age, sickness, and death would come to him too. And the sense of the suffering that comes in the wake of these experiences of impermanence, that was like having his hair on fire. There was no way around that confrontation with birth and death for him. So, his own practice effort produced some great insights into the nature of reality and the reason for suffering. And then he left quite a lot of teaching concerning how our own view of reality could be clarified so that the repeating cycles of suffering in our life as sentient beings could actually be interrupted. Until our Dharma eye is, so to speak, wide open, we're likely to have to confront a certain amount of difficulty, each of us in his or her life. And then the laboratory of suffering is right under our noses. I've been practicing for a while, you know, and yet I'm sometimes startled by how sharply suffering can erupt into my own life, like a metaphorical earthquake, although around here it could be a literal earthquake at some point. When that happens, I try pretty hard to bring the principles of practice to bear on this suffering body-mind. And in so doing, over and over again, Shakyamuni's own revelation and his gift of teaching to us are verified. Of course, at the heart of suffering is attachment. And at the heart of attachment is wrong view. We know that formula, I'm sure, all of us. So our most basic practice, particularly in our lineage, kind of goes right to the heart of wrong view by showing us how to express our life in a way that actually is consistent with right view. And one of the practices we have, of course, is sitting still as the karma of our life unfolds moment after moment, and in so doing displays the dynamic of existence, both for sentient beings and Buddhas. So at least in this style, we don't we don't try to start a world war for the sake of the defeat of Meng Yu. Instead, we cultivate in a way that supports the arising of right view, and in so doing, the energy of attachment lessens. And as that energy decreases, as that attachment decreases, suffering decreases. And this process can be likened to water dripping on stone. If by stone we mean what looks like the unyielding monolith of our lack of understanding. The mass of ancient twisted karma, as we say in our ceremonies, that we have perhaps been carting around for millennia or longer. Seems like at times, you know, it's completely impenetrable mountain of granite. But the Buddha himself, of course, used the image of very great mountain, and once a year a tiny little bird, you heard this one, flies over it, and it's very high. This little bird has to work at it, but gets up there, and as it passes the summit, its wing tip brushes the top of the mountain, and Buddha says, that for that mountain to be worn away, it would take a really long time. And our practice can feel like that. But our practice is, in fact, to just encourage the little bird to fly. And not to let ourselves get tied up in conceptions such as fast or slow, and realize that each moment of practice, as Dogen says, is actually each moment of liberation. And it may take a while for us to realize that power, but it's unmistakably there. And that power, which Tsukiroshi referred to, as you know, some wonderful power, he called it, will have some wonderful power in your practice. And then he quite wisely did not define it. I think some people asked him, what do you mean by that? And he wouldn't say, preferring to let all of us find out for ourselves about this wonderful power. So yesterday was an interesting day for me. I got to perform a wedding at City Hall. Down there in the great echoing space inside City Hall. And two men, married, who are relatively new to associating with our sangha, but quite wonderful guys. And I'm sure I expected some level of activity around City Hall, but the place was booming. And there must have been, I swear, there could easily have been 100 weddings going on in various corners. And pictures being taken and bouquets thrown. And, although you're forbidden to throw rice, there was a sign there saying you're not allowed to throw anything like rice. So, and various languages being spoken. And, there were a lot of kids around. And the feeling was quite wonderful. And then also, I got a telephone call from someone about, call it a business matter, having to do with my relation with San Francisco Zen Center. And that phone call was very bitter and painful. So yesterday I had the useful experience of this joyful encounter with sentient beings, meeting one another in a loving way, and then the bitter realities of modern life being forced back into my consciousness in order to be contemplated. And I was surprised at how painful that was. I guess, you know, if you practice a while, you may decide that maybe your hair isn't burning quite so fast. It's like, okay, you know. And then something comes along and you see, oh, yes, it is. And so I had to spend, had to pay very careful attention to my practice for quite a while in the afternoon to not kind of roll with the, you know, any bitter or angry or injured feelings that were coming up, and just let them have their expression without adding energy to them and without trying to take anything away from them either. In other words, to respect them enough to sit with them, so to speak. And to renew my effort to study the nature of these phenomena and to see how they, even when they are painful and difficult, they are pointing towards some freedom. And whereas that sort of practice can be carried on, you know, by oneself or individually, in our own practice family, there's some emphasis on joining with others to do that practice together, and in so doing, kind of drawing on each other's strength. Not just our own effort, but the strength of others. And to also to do this very, very personal and intimate practice in the presence of others, rather than, you know, just go and hide away in our own cave somewhere, which some think is easier, but it's not really. It's actually better to practice in a sangha where we know each other's effort and struggle. We can help with our quiet, calm presence. Whether, you know, actually, whether it's something wonderful going on or something painful. That presence of our fellow practitioners in our sangha is a tremendous source of nourishment and comfort. Brother, as some of you know, is a Catholic priest. Periodically, he gives me books to read, most of which I don't. But he recently gave me one that I actually did read. It was by an Episcopal priest. But he actually was raised Catholic, but he wound up joining the Episcopal Church and becoming a clergyman. And was his rather unusual childhood with a family of, I guess, there are five of them, maybe six of them. And the father was an alcoholic. And as is the case with some alcoholics, could be, you know, extremely charming some of the time and an utter monster other times. And how the story, he was telling the story in this memoir of how his childhood had been affected by this strange creature that he knew was his father. His father was also, from time to time, a clandestine agent for the CIA, which added a whole other peculiar element to the process in you know, well, where'd Dad go? Oh, well, he had to travel for business. Well, where? It was someplace like, you know, Bosnia. It's like, wait, he's going to Bosnia on business? And these things would not add up. And over the years, it became clear that there was something unusual about Dad's work. Dad had to compensate for some of the bitterness of his own work by drinking, apparently. And this had a serious impact on the family. And my brother gave me this book because our father was also an alcoholic. And nothing like the monster in this book, unfortunately. But it was interesting to see, to watch another person's progress in, might as well call it practice or spiritual life, and see how the human spirit keeps springing up and trying to move towards healing and wholeness in spite of very, very severe challenges. This is something I think we all share. Buddhists have their ways, and Christians and Muslims and Jews and so forth have their ways. But it's this same spirit yearning for and moving towards freedom that is expressing itself. And, again, this gives, conjures a feeling of brotherhood and sisterhood amongst all beings. And that fits perfectly with the power of the Bodhisattva vow. It is with those beings we are concerned, those actual living, breathing creatures. And when it's necessary to find some way to remind us, remind ourselves, remind each other of this indomitable spirit that moves towards freedom, towards self-expression, towards joy, then we can often do something. If only just by our non-judging, warm, accepting presence. That is one of the greatest gifts. And it's almost always available to be either given or received. I find very encouraging. So I'm kind of rambling this morning, and anybody has another question, maybe, or comment, or experience you'd like to share. Sometimes in a smaller group, such as we have here at Hartford Street, it's a little... Well, some people find it more intimidating if it's a smaller group. It's easier if there's like hundreds of people out there. Other people, just the opposite. Yes?
I have just more little story to share.
Yeah.
Sort of related, which is that I was talking to my father last night, and he's 82, almost 83, and lives alone. And he shared with me that he recently, well, for years he identified as an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And he shared that he recently started trying to meditate.
Oh, be darned.
Because he just, you know, he sits around a lot alone during the day and figures there's nothing.
Why not meditate?
And, you know, sort of sharing with me his challenges with that.
Oh.
I was able to get him a little bit of suggestion.
Oh, great.
But I just thought, you know, it's never too late. I was very touched and
encouraged by that. Yeah, that's great.
He said, I just want some peace of mind.
Mm-hmm. Good. And he has a daughter he can talk to about it.
So, yeah. It drips on the rock.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. It's not just our rock or our drip is
right,
the thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Jen, did you want to make
any comments? When you talked about the charming monster, the alcohol father, I had one positive like that. Mm-hmm. And so recently, it's like, how do I, and about that, so mm-hmm. it's like, how do I not like just go angry, charming, put them over there, because this is my father. And it's like, I don't really have a question to say, it's just, you brought that up, it was very helpful, it's just softening. Finding some kind of appreciation while still realizing objectively that it was very difficult.
It was very difficult, yeah. Well, me too. And, you know, there's a lot of resentment that builds up when the family as a whole is being battered around by the behaviors of, for instance, one's father. And it's taken me quite a long time to, I guess I'd say, allow that to soften into in such a way that then I can see the whole person and not just the monster. It's probably a little easier in my case because my father's alcoholism didn't manifest until I and my brother were grown. It's much worse if they're children involved. But still, it was a significant impact. And it was the subject of many, many of the hours I spent in therapy over more than 10 years. group and individual. And this book I'm mentioning describes in a quite affecting way of this the author's experience of moving from the bitterness and resentment and anger to a place where his he could see his father as just his father, just the person he was, without the tremendous energy of anger that for so many years clung to that experience. And for him as well, it seemed to have something to do with, with therapy and with his own spiritual practice, allowing these kind of harsh and rigid postures that we develop defensively to soften over time. And it can take a lifetime.
As we were talking, I just kind of realized that when I did learn survival skills from that, because
yes,
there's an alcoholic or somebody, there's a window where you can communicate with them,
yeah,
but when they're not down and they're not up.
Right.
You know, uh-huh. So like you really feel like, okay, now.
The normal, yeah, kind of, yeah, right.
And then just, yes, learning to know, okay, no, I can't talk to them. Uh-huh. There,
uh-huh.
Or over here.
Yeah. And this family in this book, mother wasn't one of, for whatever reason, didn't feel like she could leave him, although it might have been a good thing to do at some point, but she didn't. But instead, she would gather the kids and get them out of the house when it was one of the dark times, because this man could also be physically abusive. And yet there were also, as you say, there were times of some clarity where there was at least an acknowledgement that as a father, he had responsibilities to relate to his children in a way that was nourishing for them. But those were at times far few and far between. So this is, you know, this is our work. And everybody's life has some aspect of it that's difficult and gritty in this way. And that nonetheless will yield to a body that is itself learning how to soften and let go of the habit of anger and blaming and so forth. Though also like the water dripping on the rock, that can't and that should not be hurried. You can't really just try and rip through that and get to the other side. It has to take its time. And then too, in that circumstance, others can be tremendously helpful. So all of this comes under the rubric of practice, as far as I can tell. You know, it doesn't matter so much what the denomination is. The human heart seems to know its way. Sometimes it seems to get off the track a little bit, and then you have violent politics masquerading as spirituality, which is a dreadful phenomenon. So let's not do that. When I was in high school, I was proclaiming myself a Buddhist to all my Catholic family and friends. I insisted to them that, do you realize that no blood has ever been shed for Buddhism? Turns out that's not quite true, but I love to tell that to people. And then talk about body counts, you know, in Christianity and so on. It wasn't very nice of me. Anyway, I enjoyed it. I was just a teenager. Well, okay, it's probably, oh yes, late enough for us to get going. Oh, we have sewing. Tim is coming.
Oh.
Yeah. So we have to get going, and thank you very much for coming, and I hope you can stay for tea and cookies. Maybe we should do the phone ceremony next week. What do you think?
Okay.
It's already after 11.
Full moon was last
week.
Full moon was last week anyway?
Yeah.
So do it at the happy
hour. Ask
those who were visiting.
Those who are visiting, ask them. You ask them.
I don't know. Would you want to do the full moon ceremony?
Maybe they came all this way just to do the full moon ceremony.
I've got to move my car because it's expired.
Oh, you have to move your car anyway?
Yeah.
There's no 2-hour on Saturday.
Are you sure?
I
think there is.
I'm a reader.
Yeah, so they'll nail you for that. So I'm sorry, I should have kept eye on the time, but we could do it anyway, but then our sewing teacher is coming, and we have to take advantage of what he has to offer. So let's reschedule, unless hearts are broken by this.
Can't we just all of us express our remorse or our ancient karma quickly right now?
Why don't we, do you want to do the avowal of karma piece just of that? Just by sitting here? Okay. So some of you all know this, it's very short. We just repeat three times the avowal of karma verse, which goes, all my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. And I'll say it, each line, and you repeat after me, and we'll say it three times, and that'll be our acknowledgement of our karmic life for now, okay? All my ancient twisted karma.
All my ancient twisted karma.
From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion.
From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion.
Born through body, speech, and mind.
Born through body, speech, and mind.
I now fully avow.
I now fully avow.
All my ancient twisted karma.
All my ancient twisted karma.
From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion.
From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion.
Born through body, speech, and mind.
Born through body, speech, and mind.
I now fully avow.
I now fully avow.
All my ancient twisted karma.
All my ancient twisted karma.
From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion.
From beginningless greed, hate, and delusion.
Born through body, speech, and mind.
Born through body, speech, and mind.
I now fully avow.
I now fully avow.